Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Essex Market. Essex Market is New York City's most historic public market, proudly located on Manhattan's Lower East Side. Find the freshest produce, meat, fish, and specialty foods from over 30 unique vendors. Learn more about the market's family of small neighborhood businesses at essexmarket.nyc.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I am super excited to be here with you all. My name is Isra Chakkar, and I lead Oxfam's Migration and Protection Campaign. I'm a senior campaign lead based in the DC area, pretty exciting place given this past weekend. And I'm so happy to be welcoming this panel in this really timely opportunity for us to have this conversation. And so I want to welcome my esteemed guests. Before I get started into introductions, I first wanted to make sure that you all had a couple of housekeeping announcements. This panel is being recorded and English closed captioning is available. You can find the closed caption button in your list of tools on Zoom if you need to activate that. Also, you can ask questions at any time during this entire panel. We actually encourage questions here, but you go ahead and use the Q&A function and we'll do our best to get to everyone's question in this panel and hopefully during the Q&A segment. And lastly, let's get started, because I know if you're joining us on a Monday night, you are super excited to not hear me speak, but more hear our panelists, who I'm really excited and honored to be with tonight and introduce. I already introduced myself, but just to explain a bit more about the Migration and Protection Campaign at Oxfam, I manage a dynamic team that works to defend and support refugees, temporary protected status holders, asylum seekers, and anyone impacted by discriminatory policies like the Muslim bans, which personally impact me and my Syrian American family. And I'm excited to be part of this panel and want to thank our partners, first and foremost, Omnivore Books, Faden, and Snacky Tunes for bringing us all together today. Tonight, I'm joined by Darren and Greg Bresnitz, the co-founders. You can go ahead and wave. There they are, the two brothers, the co-founders and co-hosts of the music and food podcast, Snacky Tunes. Their latest book project, Snacky Tunes, Music is the Main Ingredient, Chefs and Their Music, is an extension of these soul-sustaining exchanges in which food and music seamlessly intertwine, which I can't wait to read and get to. We also are joined by Chef Preeti Mistry, if you also don't mind waving. Perfect. Is a James Beard-nominated chef, author, and activist based in Oakland and Sonoma County, California, represent. And last but not least, we have Tao Nguyen, is a Bay Area-based singer-songwriter and much-respected activist whose recent release, Temple, is one of the best-reviewed albums of 2020. So we have all of the amazing components for an amazing panel. We have chefs, we have authors and podcast hosts, and we have a singer-songwriter. Completely amazing. I want to get right in and actually start by just checking on how you are doing. Given, you know, everything that's happened this past weekend, it would be great if you wanted to share just any first thoughts and reflections for how you're coming into the space today. Please, whoever wants to jump in, go for it.
Chef, relief. It's like you let the pressure cooker release all that steam after 5 years. It's look, I know this sounds boring, but I was driving today and listening to NPR, and it was just normal NPR people talking about how the president-to-be is putting together a scientific-backed, you know, panel and experts to talk about the COVID relief. And I was like, this is the Super Bowl halftime show. I've never been more excited to hear this. Like, crank it up, you know, more liaison, absolutely amazing. It's like the bar has been put so low that just NPR Monday morning is like the concert of the new millennium.
Love it. You want to hear the news now.
Yeah.
Good news.
Want to jump in?
Good news. I feel like, I mean, I wear like one of those bite guards at night because I grind my teeth. And for some random reason, for the last two nights, I've just forgotten to put it in my mouth before I go to bed. And I'm not grinding my jaw at all. It's like the weirdest thing ever. I'm just like, really? Like, everything's totally fine. Like, I think that many people are starting to realize how much just this sort of underlying anxiety and negativity has affected everything in how they move through the world. So I think that just that like sigh of relief isn't just here. It's like a physical thing, which I think is going to be hopefully a wonderful relief for all of us.
I hear you. I feel that too. Anyone else want to feed in?
Greg?
I'm a new father. I have like a 9.5 month old daughter. And, I was like afraid what it was, I'd have to explain to her when she began to understand things about like how people can get away with things. And it feels really good to have, I think like the biggest thing about this, cause my wife and I are in the South right now. It's like, I want to make a clear distinction about not being against Republicans, but just being against immoral people as leaders. And I think like there's a clear distinction, about that type of and like being here and having to understand like what understanding why someone like that can get to the White House, but also understanding that it was never about that. It was just like, that is just a bad example as a human who should be leading us. And watching Biden just have full sentences and talk about plans and science and logic and reason and like bedrock morals, you're just like, oh yeah, I forgot. This is like, I'm like kind of not bored by the present, but like this should just be like kind of steady. So I'm excited. I will say one other thing is that like in the days when they weren't calling the election, it was the longest that Trump had been off the major networks. And I was like, this is the most calm we've had in 4 years, because they couldn't cover him because they chose to finally not cover him for lying. And I was like, oh, this is what it used to be like. You used to not have to tune in every night and hear nonsense and just like anger. So I think, Chef, I think that's probably why you're not grinding your teeth. You don't have this psychic warfare going on.
Right, exactly.
I second all that came before. And, you know, when we logged on, I asked everyone if that had actually happened, because I think we've been, oh God, the efforts, just the constant work of overcoming the latest thing and trying to figure out, you know, you try to portion out your energy so that you can address what you can, but then also continue the life that you know, the livelihood that you have to pursue, the family that you take care of, whatever, all those other things. And so you develop this muscle, unfortunately, that can't hold anything good, or you have to push through everything bad. And so it's just so nice to take a moment and celebrate and believe that the thing is good and that it's here.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you all so much for just sharing where you're at as people, as, you know, Americans, as also part of the background and expertise in which you sit. It's really important, I think, to hear how many of your messages resonate, probably with a lot of people listening to this call, if not everyone. And, you know, from Oxfam's side in particular, we congratulate President-elect Joe Biden and his hard-fought election victory to be the next president of the United States. But we also call on him to deliver on a bold new agenda that takes to scale fighting against structural injustices of poverty and inequality and immediate action on climate change. So, you know, as Oxfam, we were talking about this a little bit before we joined the big room and the audience, we were talking about how much work is just going to start beginning and how much we still need to do. And a lot of people are saying the work has just begun. And me as an activist and organizer, I say the work has been going on and now we're going to kick it into overdrive. But we as Oxfam urge President-elect Biden to urgently follow through on his campaign promises and to work with Congress to enact a transformational COVID-19 recovery plan that puts an end to the pandemic, saves the economy, and tackles the root causes of economic inequality that have been severely exacerbated by this this crisis, as well as getting the U.S. back on track to fight against poverty, inequality, and climate change overall. We have a lot more issues that we work on as Oxfam, but that is super in line with what we're talking about today. So I wanted to start off by saying that where we stand and a really good check-in. So thank you for feeding in there. I want to get right into the questions here. For years, Oxfam has partnered with creative allies, including chefs, musicians, writers, to call out injustice. We know firsthand the power in art to transform hearts and minds. What is it about food and music that make them such effective community builders? And why is it that there is such mutual respect between chefs and music artists? Anyone can start us off. I think you have a good flow between you all, so I don't want to have to choose somebody.
I mean, I guess I'll start and say, you know, food is culture and music is culture. And I think that, you know, we can either look back at these times when a lot of us were younger and we were made fun of for the food and music that came out of our homes, or we can, you know, be like the grown adults that we are now and teach our kids something different, which is what we all do with each other, which is like, oh my God, where are you from? And let me taste some of that food. And what kind of music do you listen to? And I want to hear that. And I think that there's something innate in wanting to share your culture, especially in a country with so many immigrants like America, but all over the world. You know what I mean? It's like you go to other countries. What do we go to do? I don't know. Maybe other people do something else, sit on a beach, but I go to the restaurants. I want to hear the music. I want to go to, you know, see live music. I want to go to see art. Like those are the things that make a community and a culture what it is. So I feel like there's an immediate connection, and it's also a way to immediately share something. Someone meets you and they go, oh, I've never met someone from India before. You can, you know, play a song, you can give them a plate of food or just a snack or taste of something. And it immediately gives them this whole different experience of who you are. And I feel like that's something for me that I've always like wanted to share. I'll tell you guys a funny story. When we went to a fancy restaurant of a friend of mine, we were on Top Chef together like a decade ago in Ann Arbor. And my parents live in Ohio, and the three of us went there. And even though we were going to her restaurant, of course, my parents were like, well, we need to bring something. And my mom had just made these dokra, which are like a steamed lentil cake. And so, you know, we had this like 10 course meal that she made us, and she made it all like vegetarian for my mom and all this stuff. And they had a great time, and it opened their eyes. My dad had scallops for the first time. At the same time, like everybody kept coming back from the back of the house, and the servers going, are you the ones who brought those steamed cakes? And just praising my mother in this like fancy tasting menu restaurant. And so I think it was like, it's like that immediate thing of like, you're giving me something. I want to share something from my culture, whether that's music or it's food or art. I think it's about getting to know each other and understanding each other, seeing the differences and appreciating those uniquenesses, and also seeing the similarities.
Totally. Thank you, Chef.
Tao?
I agree with everything that Chef said. And also, I mean, just, you know, these are two things that most readily transcend language and most readily can be offered as a welcoming. And I think that's why both are so powerful and deployed so widely.
Beautiful. Greg,
I think, anyone else? Greg, do you want to go?
No, you can go, Darren. I was saying Greg.
Growing up, music to us, we saw as a real powerful voice. We would go to shows and festivals like Ska Against Racism, which, you know, to us showed the power of music for our generation. You go back for every generation for centuries, and music has always been an activist cry. And now food has really hit that activist and powerful thing. I think what you've seen a lot in the, you know, post-COVID era is a lot of people who have either lost their restaurants because the government hasn't helped them and have turned to their own heritage and doing smaller pop-ups, very focused food, either from Bahamian or from like Ghana or India or things like that. And you're seeing a real voice, a real power through message saying like, this is me, this is who I am, this is the food I'm cooking. And it shares a real you know, defiant point. You're not looking anymore to, there's no central restaurant culture anymore. It's been so dispersed and decimated that people are reclaiming it for themselves. And I will say one story is that when I was in college, Greg and I went to Boston University, and I would go, I believe, to Tufts, where there was an Oxfam Cafe. And we would go there and see music, and we would get food when we had, like, you know, very lean pockets. And that, to me, always reminded that, like, you give people a place for entertainment, you give people a place to get food, you treat them like humanity, you don't look at them in any other way than just another human. And that goes a long way.
Love that. Thank you for sharing that, Darren.
And to your question about, like, what is the connection between musicians and chefs, we found this over the years. The show, the podcast, was originally just like, there's a food segment and a music segment. And after doing the podcast for 11 years, what we found is that chefs and musicians are really the same people. They want to connect with other humans in ways, and I guess Tao, this maybe is not totally relevant because you're also a lyricist, but music and food are both kind of, in, you know, nonverbal ways of communication and connecting with other people. And sometimes even lyrics, when you maybe don't listen to the words as much, but the way that voice is used as a way that, like, certain spices are used as accents or layers on top of dishes, it allows for people to be able to find this way. And I think in the way that when you perform intimate shows and you have dinner service, you're able just to really identify with the person across from you and touch them in ways that transcends language. And that was only something that we really understood after many years of doing the show. I mean, like, wait, was it a chef or musician who gave us that answer before? This is interesting. And that was kind of like what we also found within the book, that, you know, most chefs' first love was music, or first identifier was music. And then it sprung from there. So I think maybe it's not as totally recognized as it should be, but, you know, chefs and musicians are connecting with people on such a different level with intangible values, through tangible connections, that there's just this unspoken bond in the way that they do it.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And I wanted to revisit Darren's point about the relationship between chefs and musicians and the restaurant industry and the music industry in this particular moment. Mm. And I've been a part of panels or discussions around the future of the music industry and what's happened and how it's been decimated. And I've taken such inspiration and motivation from the way restaurateurs and different people within the food industry have responded to this. And I feel very strongly that both industries, live music and food, are facing, obviously, a lot of this the same struggle, and have historically been navigating within that extremely narrow, thin margin. And if anything goes wrong, you're done. You know, it's such a precarious position, and it's underfunded, underappreciated in, you know, at state and federal levels. But the way people in food have been adapting and figuring out how to survive has been really inspiring for musicians like myself.
You know, we finished this book in about April, May of this year, and every restaurant in this book is an independent restaurant. And we're starting to see more and more restaurants that have been listed or chefs in this book have closed up shop. And the sad thing is that it means so much to so many people on so many different levels, whether it's just spiritual or connectivity, but financial. I mean, you look at the numbers and what these restaurants do. I mean, Preeti, I know that you and so many of your chefs feed communities, you know, like, charity work has become such a big part of it. And so when these independent restaurants start disappearing, you start losing a hub. And, you know, a lot of times these people are working with food banks and they're donating their time and their celebrity, and Tal, you're the same way. And it's just like, if you lose this community, it's more than just going out to eat and going to see his shows. You're losing a place where people can support other people. And it has taken so long to get to this point with restaurants and independent venues and artists. And it is going to take a long time to come back if people do not step in and save these industries. And you are seeing it every day with restaurants closing and charities losing money. And there's just like, look, we can put all the free fridges and we can buy all the merch in the world, but at a federal level, you need to support this billion-dollar industry on both sides.
And Darren, go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, I mean, I think that that's something that, like, I mean, I feel like I've been saying this for years. I was very fortunate that I had closed both my restaurants, and in 2018, I was about to work on a consulting project opening another restaurant, which I didn't end up doing and isn't happening. And then I was opening my own places, which is currently totally on hold. But I think that also, like, the thing about it is that, like, both music and food, like, first of all, you need food literally to, like, live. And I would tend to say that even though, yes, you wouldn't, like, die, we need music. Every culture, you know, creates music. And so I think there's also a thing when you talk about, like, venues and restaurants, it's like there was a point in our, like, world where, you know, people only cooked for themselves and for their community and made music with their community. And where's that point where you're like, okay, not everybody knows how to play the guitar or cook themselves a meal, and where those things that are so important in our life become not seen by the government, to your point, Darren, as important, where, you know, whether it's who's gotten a bailout, you know, fast food chains, which I'm not totally knocking, honestly, because at the end of the day, there's a lot of folks that that's the only food they can afford. And they don't have time to cook because they're working. But ultimately, these large businesses getting all these tax breaks, it's no different than it was before the pandemic. You know, it was Twitter getting this huge tax break. But why do people come to San Francisco and Oakland? I mean, yes, some come for business to work at the Twitter building, but why do they, you know, why is Oakland the new spot everybody wants to go to? It's the music, it's the culture, it's the restaurants, it's the art. Like, those are the reasons. And yet the government does absolutely nothing to incentivize us. And yet they give Twitter, this company with so much money, this massive tax break just to open up their headquarters there. So I think that when you look at, like, you know, when people talk about the amount of money that is being lost in San Francisco and Oakland right now because of the lack of tourism. How many conventions that feed all of those restaurants and music venues and also musicians that are performing at these events privately. All of that is not supported in any real way because, as you say, Darren, it's mostly all independent people. So it's not like this one company, boom, you give them this tax break, it has this effect. It's like all of these individuals that you have to somehow, like, access. I don't think it's actually that hard. But I do think that maybe what I felt even pre the pandemic will finally, like, kind of sink in for more and more people, that independent restaurants, like musicians, like, these are things that we need in our world. And when we're in this place where we're actually lacking those things, maybe we have a moment with COVID to, like, realize what is really important to us and that these things are super important and we can't let them fail. And we can't let the folks that create these beautiful things in our culture not be supported.
Yeah, that was so great. Thank you all for your insightful thoughts. I mean, that kind of leads us perfectly into the second question, which is COVID-19 has profoundly impacted our food systems. Millions of people around the world are being pushed into hunger. The entire food industry has faced a seismic change, which you already hinted on, all of you. And food and farm workers have become frontline essential workers. How has COVID impacted your relationship with food? And what effects are you seeing in other communities? I know, Chef, you were just talking about Oakland, in particular in San Francisco. Did you want to add anything to this question? And then I'll open up the floor to anyone else.
Yeah, actually, I mean, there's a lot of things. one thing is I'm actually not in Oakland right now, even though I'm always repping Oakland. I'm actually about an hour and a half north up in Sonoma County in the Redwoods. And we've been here since March. And long story, we bought this house last year, got rid of the rental in Oakland. And so we're up here for the foreseeable future. What that also meant was back in April, I actually started working at a small organic farm that was owned by friends of mine. And I've had the opportunity to get more stuck in with farm work. When I first started working, I was the only person on the farm except for the couple that owned the farm. One who was a photographer, but all her business was gone because of the lockdown. And so it was me and the photographer and the farmer, a bunch of 40 something lesbians farming. I feel like it's in the same way that I've had the opportunity to kind of connect more deeply with what food and where it comes from and how it's grown. And I mean, I've always worked with small farms and small farmers. This was just an opportunity to go a lot deeper, and physically be there working and learn a tremendous amount. I think that everybody has connected more deeply with cooking and food, whether they're making sourdough or what have you. It's like everybody's like, you know, having to figure a lot of stuff out. And I feel like there's a different level of connection to what food means to a lot of folks.
You know, I gotta, I hope y'all don't mind if I hop in next, but, and Chef and I didn't plan this, but cause I don't think you know, but Isra, your question about how are we more connected? So to our food supply, I've always subscribed to this one CSA, but then I'd been on the wait list for the farm that Chef Preeti works at now.
Oh yeah, Radical Family Farms.
Yeah, Radical. We can say their name. Okay, so
yeah,
Radical Family Farms,
yeah.
Because they're I mean, I heard about them. They're amazing, and they specialize in Asian heritage produce. Is that right? Is that fair to say? And they're queer owned, queer run, and I will say two CSA subscriptions is a bit much, and it gets a little stressful, but I couldn't pass up the opportunity to support and also to be cooking with these ingredients that it's hard to get, it's hard to source, and they remind me so much of growing up and the food that I grew up with, and I'm, you know, connecting more with my mom around recipes. So
that's so awesome. I'm so excited that you've been getting the CSA boxes.
I love it. I love it. We can talk more about that later.
So. Yeah. Yeah. When we actually hang out socially and not just be on panels together.
I would say on the other side of it. So I have been in New York the last 15 years until COVID. And now I am in Lafayette, Louisiana, where my wife is family from, and where the hurricanes have just like ripped through here, but it's not like an equal opportunity destruction. It's of course neighborhoods of people underneath the poverty line, BIPOC communities. And what's really sad is that the media is really good at covering the lead up and the destruction, right? Like they're really good at that. I've never felt more people reach out to me and be like, are you okay? And I was like, we're 40 miles away, which is a very significant thing. But no one is really talking about the recovery. No one is talking about the damage. It was done during it's still hot down here. It's really hot. Today it was like shorts weather. It's still really humid. So when these went through, people lost power, they lost, they lost the refrigeration, and it just kind of disappeared. So watching people who are already on the edge, and then were like very good fodder for ratings, but not really good fodder for relief, is pretty amazing. Like it was just today that I think Zeta was the most recent that Lafayette Parish and five other parishes finally got relief from one of the things, but like they're still waiting. Cleanup is still good. The cleanup crews are gone. So I think seeing how the pandemic pushes people, plus global warming pushes people on the edge, already over the edge, and then forgotten about, has been pretty amazing to see like just how quickly to it, and something that I was completely ignorant to while living in New York City. And you just kind of see, it's like these people just feel abandoned due to this, and no one is coming to help them because it's not a good story.
Essex Market is a food lover's paradise with over 30 unique vendors selling everything from one-of-a-kind spices to daily grocery staples and even scratch-made prepared foods. At HRN, we believe that buying from local purveyors is one of the best ways to support an equitable food system. That's why this holiday season we'll be shopping from the vendors at Essex Market. Not only are their offerings fresh and delicious, they're also affordable and sold by a community of passionate small business owners. This connection is what has made Essex Market a stalwart in New York City's food landscape for the last 80 years. Now located in a brand new building, Essex Market continues to be one of the most unique food experiences in New York. At Essex Market, you'll find Lower East Side locals shopping for plantains and avocados, alongside visitors browsing freshly baked bread and locally produced cheeses. If this gets you hungry, order from one of the market's many prepared food vendors, serving up dishes from Peru, Thailand, Morocco, and beyond. Learn more and shop online for local same and next day delivery at essexmarket.nyc.
I wanted to really focus on women specifically, because women do play a vital role in producing our food around the world and in the food industry here in the U.S. At Oxfam, we think women must be included in any decisions about how we revamp our food systems, but we still have a long way to go, which I think a lot of your commentary has already proven that and spoken to that. Where are you seeing women making strides in the food industry, and what work still needs to be done?
Well, I mean, I feel like first and foremost, like it's kind of a ridiculous thing, right? Like women are traditionally the people who have been cooking in households and communities for like since the beginning of like time. And yet for some reason, as soon as you put on a white jacket and get this big knife, it's this like really male thing.
Right.
I would say the same is also true to maybe not as disproportionate, is in farming. And one thing that I, not just because of my recent experience, but even prior, have seen a lot more women going into farming and being interested in going into farming, which I think is a super important part of the food system, because when we just like stop it, you know, it's sort of like getting deeper, right? So it's like, oh, we'll let you be in pastry and salads. And it's like, no, I want to work the grill. I want to be the executive chef. And then saying, okay, I have this great restaurant and I'm the chef and I'm the owner and I get all this great produce from all of these guy farmers. But saying, no, I want to be the farmer. I want to learn more about this. I want to do this. I mean, from my understanding, the largest amount, I believe there's a higher percentage of women at Culinary Institute of America, and in culinary schools across the country. And I think also there's a larger percentage of women, young women, in terms of young farmers, it's more women. So I see that really shifting things, because I think that when we get out of just, you know, making pastries and writing about food, but actually growing it, and then being in charge of it, I think that that's where you see a lot of change. The other thing I see, which I think is being somewhat having a positive sort of boost because of COVID, is people sort of moving more towards more simple comfort food. And, you know, I mean, for those of you who know me, or for those of you who don't, like, I am not a huge fan of fine dining. I kind of think it's bullshit. And so for me, I feel like, you know, fine dining has really shown during this time that it is clearly not essential. But do you want to get that stack of tortillas and that pound of carnitas and that quart of beans and that quart of guacamole and chips and salsa? Yes. To feed your family? Yes. So I think that the way that we start looking at food as a people and understanding, like, in through this process of COVID, there's been this extreme, like, people are just like, I want that comfort. I want that thing. I want that, like, this, in, you know, I bring it up again, like, this focus on sourdough. It's like bread, like fucking bread, like the thing that is the most basic sort of, you know, square one of what creates a cuisine, whether that's a loaf in this case, because this, you know, we're talking about America and sort of European focus, or you're talking about flatbreads or all kinds of breads. Like, that is like, you know, whether it's breads or rice, it's sort of like the foundation of any cuisine, and people focusing on those like basic essentials. And finding comfort in that, and finding, because ultimately food is about nourishment, and it's about joy, it's about pleasure, and it's also about nourishment. Like, we need it to live. But you know, the sort of smoke and mirrors and smoked mackerel hanging from a wire with some essential oils floating up, like, nobody's like, oh, I really wish we could do that again. You know, I don't hear that from anyone. Like, I mean, maybe it's just because I don't talk to folks like that. But I'm not saying like people don't like nice things and that I don't like nice things. Like, I'm not talking about like Zuni. I'm talking about like super fine dining, things that go beyond nourishment and are really just about an experience or a performance, if you will, that costs an exorbitant amount, that don't really, you know, you might end up going to In-N-Out on your way home. I personally go to those restaurants and I'm just like halfway through, I'm like, I can't eat anymore. I'm full. Why do I have to eat all this food? So I think that in a lot of ways, it's really just about like getting more back to like this essential place of what we really crave. And I feel like this moment is really suited to women in the food industry, because, you know, and not to say that there aren't women who cook fine dining, but if you look at sort of the scale, I would say, you know, there's a few women in fine dining, whereas there's a lot of women chefs who are cooking with, you know, everything from like the sort of Zuni mid-range quality bistro meal that's very nourishing to, you know, your taco truck situation. Like that spectrum. And I feel like that's the spectrum that people are like, this is what I'm craving. This is what I want. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, and it makes sense because women are who have traditionally fed our communities. Mm-hmm. Plain and simple.
That's completely true, chef. I think about my own mom, like my entire experience with cooking and like food. I'm not a chef. I'm not very good. I mean, I'm pretty good at Middle Eastern dishes. I'm not good at other dishes to cook them, but it's all through my mom. And I remember my mom, there have been different parts in life where she's catered for our community. She's helped community out with food. So it's so important to even tell the stories of our generation, our home countries through food. So yeah, women are essential. They are the core of that. Did anyone else want to feed into this question?
Yeah, so I'll take it from a media coverage side and an award side. So there's really two issues I still see. And I say this completely aware that I am a Jewish straight white male. And so if I misspeak or say the wrong thing, you know, it's still an education process. So, you know, one of the biggest stories that came out in the last 2 weeks was the Master Sommeliers of America, about how there was an unbelievable amount of decades of sexual harassment and, you know, more than just harassment, like assault and things like that. And you're talking about one of the toughest, hardest career choices. It's very niche. And one of the most, the saddest things beyond the actual harassment itself were women who said, I don't want to follow this career. Like, these men that hold the power are keeping me from following my dreams. And I was like, could you imagine in this day and age? I mean, you can, and I say this, but just like to dedicate your life to this and then saying like one guy who probably doesn't even remember what he did because he was drunk. And this is nothing new in this industry or even the restaurant industry in it as a whole. And that throws someone's life off balance. Like, it's just, it's nuts. And then on the compendium side of that is, I can't even remember which, maybe it was like, I can't remember which chef award international that released names this year, but it was nuts. Cause if you looked at it, it was all white men from around the world. I think there was two white women, and it was just like, and I wrote them. I commented, I wrote them. I was like, how the fuck are you even thinking that this is okay right now? Like, how are you this tone deaf? And I know that it is a huge issue with San Pellegrino and James Beard Award. You know, that's a whole other topic. And so the idea that this is the crazy part, like this isn't out of the conversation anymore. Like so much of women and representation and what is considered pretty sort of what you said, like fine dining, like how is that still sitting at the center of the awards when so many of things are not really like the best conversations are not around fine dining, right? Like no one's, I mean, I get it and I respect it on some level, but like that's not what calls to me, especially not during this time. And to see misogyny and to see racism at some level and to be like, well, if you can't afford fresh linens every 2 days, then you don't get that fourth star. It's like, what the fuck does that even, who cares about that? And, you know, we have done our part as Snacky Tunes. I'm not saying we're the solution, but like the book and the radio show and the things like that, like we have done our best to do representation because that's like the power that we have to do it. But again, it's like we are one little thing. Like that is not enough. Like there are systematic things. And not to go back to COVID, but like maybe this complete breakdown and this eye on the restaurant industry and the music industry, take a breath and go like, what is wrong? So that when we come back, we are not just going back to this old guard of all these problems. And maybe that is the silver lining here. But to see this stuff still existing and to people know that it's part of the conversation and still going, I don't care. Like, I'm still going to harass. I'm still going to pay people less. I'm still not going to promote. Like it doesn't make it's insane because I don't think most people who eat and who actually want that are okay with that anymore.
You know, one thing that you just reminded me of, it, which I've drawn again, I draw a great amount of inspiration from what happens in the food world, but what happened with Bon Appetit and the you know, so many of the people who were making those food videos but not getting paid, like Priya Krishna and forgive me, I don't know them well enough to know all their names, but I know that the steps that they took to leave and to say, even after Adam Rappaport left and you know, they're trying to reorganize and figure out how to justly pay people and compensate them. And then that accommodation fell short. And the ferocity of the people who were just like, fuck it, I'm out. You don't deserve what I can do. And now, and they're being valued for their work at the level with which they should be valued and have found different opportunities, you know, with their own channels or whatever they're doing, you know, in different writing assignments with the Times or wherever. But it was so remarkable to see and how vocal they were and how very clear mm-hmm. that their language was in leaving.
I think it's a silver lining too in a lot of ways, because I think that, like, for me, I felt like the system is broken and hasn't worked for a lot of folks for a long time, if it ever did. Mm-hmm. And this moment has really opened a lot more people's eyes to, like, a lot of the injustices and, you know, the kind of biases that, you know, people like me are like, I kind of assume that, but other people were like, oh no, it couldn't be, like, they have a whole process. Like, I'm sure they're good people. And I'm like, okay. And now it's like, see, I've told you, I told you. But at least, like, more people are getting it, whether it's seeing, like, Thomas Keller suck up to Trump or, like, Danny Meyer come out with this, like, fine people on both sides statement yesterday or what have you. I think that you're seeing a lot, and the ratio of people that it's not just about, like, there's going to be people like me who are always going to be, like, hella skeptical and, like, on the left that are just like, okay, I see you. But, like, there's many people that are fooled by these layers of, like, white men's charm and money and affluence and, you know, lip service of equality. And I think in this moment, in the last few months, you've really started to see a lot of people just be like, hey, Thomas Keller, like, you were my hero and I don't think so anymore, or unfollow, or I don't need to go to your place, or, you know, whatever, where a lot of folks are opening their eyes to the fact that these people that they have put on these pedestals are not so great. And in fact, the way that they were able to get to where they are is at the detriment of so many women and BIPOC folks, queer folks, that, you know, and then there's folks like you're saying, Tao, that are like, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I'm not going to keep, you know, getting paid less than these folks. And I think that also is because of this moment and people just feeling like, I'm fed up. Like, I'm not going to keep putting up with this. Like, this is the ultimate, like, you know, we all had it, like, right after Trump got elected, we all had it when Brett Kavanaugh got, you know, on the Supreme Court, those moments where you're like, not today, not today. Do not mess with me today. But I feel like this moment, COVID has really pushed a lot more people to really see like, oh, wow, they really don't care about us at all.
I think I do want to give one, like, there's always like darkness in this, but I think one, you always look for like educational.
Sorry.
I know. No. Well, I mean, it is darkness. So like 5 years ago, I used to work for a company. We were the co-host for Food Book Fair, and it was a panel, five people on the panel. Two of the people on the panel were Mary Batali and Ken Friedman. It's 2015. If you are not aware, they were two of the most heinous people of all time. And the topic of the panel was about recognition in recognition for essentially cultural appropriation. And my mom was there. And they, and all the people on the panel, not everyone on the panel, like there was like a NYU NYU professor and everything. And the people on the right side of history were saying like, cite your sources. We're not even saying like, you know, give money to the people you're taking from. But if you're a white person doing Chinese food, like just say that you didn't grow up with this and someone taught you and maybe someone will want to discover. It was around the same time when like two white women went down to Mexico and like stole recipes from Mexican women and then got run out of Portland, which was like awful. So I was like, yeah, cite your sources. My mom was like, I'm not sure about this. You know, it kind of takes away from the meal. And my mom is like amazing school teacher. And so we've had like a 5-year debate about this. Like it's been like an ongoing type of thing. And just recently, the New York Times started citing its sources. It's incredible. They kind of came, I think it was about a month ago or maybe 2 months ago, where Sam Sifton was like, you know what? We didn't come up with all these recipes. A lot of them are adapted. Here's the original person. Here's the adaption. It takes away nothing. If you want to learn from them, go learn from them. And took away nothing. I showed it to my mom and she was like, this is correct. This is absolutely correct. And just yesterday she texted me, she's signing up for Biden's task force. She's like getting involved. She's like getting amongst it. You know, she's been like a reading school teacher, reading school specialist her entire life. And I think that when you see these kind of movements change, you kind of understand these things, you see this kind of arc, you get to see people who find these entry points now that maybe felt either didn't know that they needed to look for an entry point or felt embarrassed or didn't know how to get in. And now I think what we're seeing is there's enough time for people like, you know what? I'm going to fail. I'm going to say the wrong things. I'm going to be ignorant, but I'm going to be okay with that because I'm going to learn and I'm going to do the reading and I'm going to use my position and show up.
That's really powerful. And on that point of activism, thank you all for sharing your thoughts. Tao, I have a question for you. In Interview Magazine, you said, quote, I think I'm more effective as an activist if I stay in music, to be honest. Music, the way it reaches people and transcends divisions, is a really effective and powerful forum, end quote. What's been the most powerful experience you've had combining your music and activism?
That's funny. I just don't remember saying that, but I don't disagree with it. I
love it. Love it.
I think the most powerful moment for me with music, and what's funny, what gives me pause is that it wasn't necessarily this platform that I believe music gives me versus me being more on the front lines of activism and organizing. I will say that I can't be on the front lines because I don't have the constitution for it. And my admiration for organizers and activists who are called to do it and do it so well are the reason we are anywhere good. I have endless respect, and so I'll say that. So with music, the moment that comes to mind is in 2013, I released a record called We the Common, and it was written in tribute to the California Coalition for Women Prisoners. And one of the songs, the title track, the lead single off the record is called We the Common for Valerie Bolden. And it was inspired in part by the first visit that I ever made to a state prison. And I was working with an advocacy group. So I was able to meet with several people inside throughout the day. And it was just the experience was something it would be too much to go into because it was just so overwhelming on every level. So I ended up writing this song, and I brought my banjo to a protest. We were protesting, well, there's a ton of things to protest within the California correctional system. But what it was, that particular protest was about medical oversight and what was happening, just really egregious response and neglect of incarcerated people. And we were situated such that people inside could hear us. And we had come to the prison with family members of those who were inside. And I remember playing that song, We the Common, which I'd played a ton before. I played it on tour all over. We play, you know, we made a music, whatever. You perform that song a lot when it's the lead single from a record. But that is by far the most poignant, most meaningful experience I've had with music and what kind of service it can be, what kind of vehicle you can, you know, what you can, what service you can be as a person who plays music.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Tao, for sharing that. One more question before we go into the audience Q&A. I know that we're a little tight on time, but this next question is for Chef. In your Time article, I'm a Queer Brown Immigrant Chef, you wrote, quote, "As a queer brown immigrant chef, I have no interest in backing down. Revolutions were not staged without making someone uncomfortable. Rights were not gained by accepting the status quo. When we speak up, we do so because we are full of optimism," end quote. How have you been able to sustain this optimism? We've heard a lot about, honestly, I think really insightful thoughts on the current state of everything today and hopefully the shift that's going to be coming in the food industry that's already happened, as well as the music industry. But where are you at with this optimism?
Well, I mean, of course, this weekend was a huge boost in optimism. I mean, we all are feeling, breathing a little bit easier. And I think that first and foremost, I got a Facebook memory yesterday, which was the date of the election 4 years ago. It reminded me that 4 years ago, I taught a cooking class with a bunch of mostly all Black youth in Oakland. And we had a great time. And I remember, like, afterwards, you know, then I went home and we saw the election results start to come in and it was like, oh God, this is like the worst night ever. And just thinking about like these young people and, you know, looking at the 18 to 29 vote. And I think I posted the photo and said something like, you know, and if this is our future, I know that we're going to be okay no matter what happens with this election. And I think that that is really true because, you know, the way that young people have come out all around the country, it has been so impressive and, you know, it makes me emotional. And so I feel like first and foremost, like I see the optimism in our youth. I see the optimism in the way that it's like, I mean, it's the millennials, but also Gen Z's just like, hey, move over. Like millennials, like some of them are like, I'm jaded, I'm angry. Gen Z's just like, let's do this. TikTok, we're going to take you down. They're creative. And they understand the concept really of like, the way that you can, like, whether it's because of social media or what, the way that if you can get the numbers and out-ratio somebody, you can really make a difference and change something, whether you look at K-pop and what they did or what the kids did with the Republican convention, all these different things, like it's really impressive to me. I think the youth is just like so much optimism. I think the other optimism I have is like, I always have optimism because like I'm in Oakland, I'm in the Bay Area, and my community has always been fighting. We didn't just start fighting in 2016. We didn't just start saying Black Lives Matter in June of 2020. Like we've been doing this all along. It's always been a part of who we are. We pick each other up. We hold each other's hands. We say, you know, what can we do? How can I help you? And so I always feel optimism because I feel like I am in a community, whether you're talking about just Oakland or you're talking about the chef community, or the small business community in the Bay Area that doesn't wait around for government bailouts. They just like roll up their sleeves and start helping. So I feel like overall a lot of optimism, but definitely, yeah, this weekend gave us hella optimism.
Boost we needed. And I agree with you. I think the root of optimism for all of us is really community and where we stand with that. So shifting into the audience Q&A, I love hearing all your thoughts, but we need to be as brief as possible so that we can get through these questions for people online. I'm going to first start off with a question for Tao. Tao, someone wrote, as a Vietnamese American, I want to tell her, I think she wrote thank you very much in Vietnamese. She's been such an icon to folks like me. What advice would she give young Vietnamese Americans who are looking to get involved in activism but are worried about what their parents or family might say?
Thank you, whoever wrote that. I'll try to be brief as possible, but this questions like these, typically I end up crying and I'll probably have to ask for your email to further explain. I would say, don't deny yourself your truth and don't deny yourself your heritage. And if you keep pushing forward, the two shall meet and you can live fully.
So beautiful. That's so beautiful. Thank you, Tao. And thank you. That was really brief, so I really appreciate it. But I think that a lot of different communities can relate to that. A lot of different people from different backgrounds. Beautifully said. Thank you for that. Question for Darren and Greg. How does music and food come into advancing progressive and within progressive anti-systemic racism, counter-abusive policing, etc., actions and movements under a Biden presidency, in your opinion?
To be as succinct as possible.
Yeah, also a question that's not very brief. Yeah, broad
question. I think that they can act as Trojan horses for people who are unable to face certain truths or paint things in black and white or in the good, bad, like binary paradigm. Food and music allows people to be like, hey, does this move you or does this connect you? Are you curious about where this sound comes from? Are you curious where this food comes from? Does it provide some type of understanding? Are you curious? Do you want to learn more about it? From messaging, I mean, we were talking before, Chef was telling me about this beer that she's drinking by. Hold it up again? Yeah. Run by queer women brewers. And you're like, oh, what is it called again?
It's Almanac Brewery, but this one is called the Prince of Demons.
The Prince of Demons. And then we're like, oh, are there a lot of women in brewing? Oh, there's not. Like, and just that's just how our brains work because we can ask those questions, but it like allows for conversation in that way. I mean, music and activism is like hand in hand, like every anti-war song ever, or identity, or Tao for your new record about your own personal struggle with identity and your heritage, which is really beautiful in the way in that you've addressed it is just really stunning. I think both of them can be done either way. You can just be like, oh, like, let me find out these things on my own terms. So I think if you choose the right food and the right music to convey the message, and if Biden can do that, and pick artists in the same way that they go after like the clothing that First Lady wears, they do the food and music, it allows for new conversations in like easy, almost bite-sized ways.
Darren, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I mean, to dovetail what Greg said, I think that Trump had a famous photo with fast food as a celebratory dinner for college athletes. I think it'd be very different if he had someone like a Kwame come and cook and talk about the heritage there. But to be honest, look no further than our two panelists here about how food and music can result in activism and conversation. Tao with your new record, and Temple, you know, Preeti with the farm that you're working on. Like, if that isn't two examples of how these two disciplines spark conversation to get people thinking about how they get involved, and that creation and actions are political now more than ever, I don't know what else is.
Perfectly said. A question for anyone: what is the best way to ensure the food we buy isn't causing turmoil or even harm for someone along the supply chain?
I guess I'll take that one. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, first and foremost, like, there's ways to be informed. Grist is a really great, grist.org is a great environmental food blog that I follow. Civil Action as well is another one, or Civil Eats, that's what it is. And then I think there's a lot of things that you just got to kind of think about for a minute. You know, it's sort of like when there was that big expose in the New York Times about, I think it was mostly Vietnamese, but Asian women in the mani-pedi salons in New York City, and that there was all this exploitation. Yeah. And then I remember, like, some, you know, chef friend of mine writing something like, you got a mani-pedi for like $12, and it took a New York Times article for you to think about the fact that there's exploitation going on? Like, come on. Like, I think the person said something like, be please. But like, to the point is sort of like, when you see something that cheap, like, sourcing quality ingredients, paying your employees properly in a safe environment, and delivering that food to people, whether that's on a plate or in a box or what have you, is not cheap. It's human labor, whether you're talking about the farm worker or the dishwasher or the delivery driver. So anytime you're getting that at what feels like a steal, someone is getting harmed along the way. You are benefiting because someone along that chain has been exploited, or the environment has been exploited, or both. So that, you know, I think that, like, a lot of it is educating yourself and asking questions. And then I think some of it is just like, just stop and think and have some common sense about, like, how is it possible that this is that cheap? And ask the right questions, or just like, maybe don't make that choice, because, you know, anything that you buy that feels like, oh wow, this is really cheap for this, you know, whatever, like fish and chips, like, it's probably some like farmed whatever crazy fish from some place where people were exploited. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of that when it comes to seafood and whatever. Whatever the situation is, whether it's farm workers or seafood or the dishwasher, like, someone is being exploited if you're getting something for something that feels like a steal or just like really cheap.
Thank you. Oh, go ahead, Darren.
Just one thing to add on that, and I know we brought this up before, is that sometimes people don't have the luxury of being able to spend an exorbitant amount of money on food. But there are, if you dig into the government, there are crazy farm subsidies. There are a lot of programs to help feed people, and those need to be re-examined now more than ever as well. You know, food scarcity, food dependency, hunger in America, hunger throughout the world, it doesn't have to exist. Like, there is more than enough food to feed people, and there's more than enough money there. And, you know, there's enough money to get people fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, you know, EBT at green markets, farmers markets, things like that. And it's just a re-examination of who we prop up and who we support, and education as well. Nutrition, that fundamental understanding of what's good for you and healthy and not just cheap and quick. It's a whole ecosystem. And so once you start diving into that, you know, sometimes you can blame people like, you know, fast food or things like that. But like, that is a systematic end of giant federal issues that you see playing out in real time right now. And if you can attack the whole, I mean, look, I'll put it this way. If McDonald's thought that they could get more people to eat salads and that was more profitable, you know, and, you know, whole grains, they wouldn't serve another burger. You know, they're not driven. It's not driven by like, we need to get these burgers out. It's not like the head of McDonald's now is like, if I, my core is selling burgers, if they could sell, you know, whole, you know, oatmeal or fresh fruit, they would do it, but that's not profitable. Those aren't the systems that aren't set up. So I think that's another thing that might be silver lining in this is like reexamining our food ways, reexamining our relationship with that. And just, I remember when Greg and I drove across Canada, this was 2000, and they were doing these test pilots of salads in McDonald's. And it was like this healthy wave. And I was like, oh, I hope this comes to America. I was like, oh, cheap salads that actually aren't that bad. And it never made it. But it was just like, you could just see that it's just profit and product driven. And if health is at the center of it, it's a win for everyone.
That's perfectly said and a great way to leave us off. Darren, I wanted to also reiterate the point that many people think hunger is about too many people and too little food, but that is not the case. At Oxfam, we know that hunger is about power. Ultimately, its roots lie in inequalities and access to resources and opportunities. Right now, our world produces enough food for everyone, but approximately one out of every nine of us will still go to bed hungry tonight. So we are over time. So thank you everyone who has stayed on so far. We are about to post a link to Oxfam's donation page in the chat box right now. Please consider joining us or continuing support of our efforts, either in a big or a small way. Your contribution will go to help people around the world facing injustice, support communities working to lift themselves out of poverty, and aid families seeking safety. I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. I want to thank Tao, Chef, Preeti, Darren, and Greg. Major thanks to Omnivore Books, Phaedon, and the whole Snacky Tunes team. Remember to check out all of their work on their social media. If you want to drop it into the Q&A box, feel free to really continue to support these amazing, amazing independent artists in every way, shape, or form. It's been such an honor to be with you all tonight in community and in conversation. And I hope that we can get together soon and do this again. Thank you to everyone for joining us. If we were not able to get to your questions, we'll hopefully follow up with you offline and have a great and wonderful Monday evening. Thanks, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much. Bye, y'all.
Bye.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.